I'm Jason Mundock, and this is Around the Wood Stove from the Wood Stove House in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Buddy Mundlach has been a successful songwriter and performer since the late 1980s. Based in Nashville, his songs have been recorded by Nancy Griffith, Guy Clark, David Wilcox, Garth Brooks, and many more. In 2002, Buddy teamed up with songwriters Maya Sharp and legend Art Garfunkel to write and record an album for EMI Manhattan that led to a national tour with Art's band. On his own, he has recorded 3 studio albums, including the 2007 release, The Edge of the World. In February 2011, Buddy joined us at the Woodstove House for the first house concert of the year. Well, joining me in the Woodstove House is Buddy Mundlach. Welcome to Lancaster.
Thanks.
We're really excited to have Buddy in town tonight to perform at one of our Woodstove House concerts. And Buddy is coming to us from Nashville, but you grew up in Chicago, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, actually in the suburbs. I was out in Park Forest, Illinois, which is a south suburb of Chicago.
I want to first start with digging in a little bit to your time post-college in Chicago in that songwriter scene. What was going on in Chicago at that time? I read in on your website or in one of your bios about performing with Steve Goodman at a New Year's Eve party and that being sort of a pivotal show.
Yeah, so
what was happening in the scene at that time?
Well, the Earl of Old Town had an open stage every Monday night. Okay. And that's kind of where I got started, you know, sort of worming my way into the scene there. And I knew about this place because the Old Town School of Folk Music, where I had been taking lessons. And also because, you know, the Earl of Old Town, that's where Steve Goodman used to play and John Prine and guys like that. And I used to go see Bonnie Kolak there, you know, when I was in high school, go on a Sunday matinee and with my dad and sisters. And so, yeah, like, that was the place. I really wanted to, you know, that's my vision of success, was to get a gig at the Earl someday, you know.
And so you were playing, an open mic?
Yeah, and they, one of the waitresses there was a real go-getter, Kate Smith, and she kind of decided she wanted to organize these open stagers. You know, a lot of the same people would come back every week and do something to kind of get them more out into the world. And so they had this event called Best of the Open Stage at the Earl, and I think there were 10 of us who ended up competing. They made it a 2-day competition, and they had local music critics as judges and things like that, and I participated in that. I wasn't one of the winners, but Earl's son Joey kind of just took a shine to me, you know, from seeing me at that, and took an interest. So later on that year, I started to get some gig offers. Fred Holstein asked to have me open for him. And later on, I got to open for Gamble Rogers. That was one of the first.
At the Earl?
At the Earl, yeah.
Okay.
So I started getting some opening things there. Fred and Gamble and a couple other people. And as New Year's approached, Joey said, "Well, I got some good news for you. You're opening for Steve Goodman on New Year's Eve." And that was like the big show of the whole year. I couldn't believe it. So yeah, it just got me out there and recognized a little bit more.
Let's talk about Kerrville.
Okay.
Because at least I'm trying to connect some dots on your story.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems like Kerrville Folk Festival?
Right.
Has been a big part of your career.
For sure. I mean, as like the Earl and that whole scene there was me coming out in Chicago and starting to become a professional, you know, singer-songwriter or performer anyway. Kerrville would be where I came out on the national circuit, you know, where people from other places might have gotten to know me.
What was your first experience like there? Did you just show up, or were you on the bill?
I had met Bob Gibson. I'd opened for him in Park Forest, where I grew up. They have a little theater there, and I'd opened for him in 1980. And he was involved in the Kerrville Folk Festival and the songwriting school there, and he encouraged me to check it out and come do the songwriting school. And so I was all set to go. The festival starts at the end of May. And that year, on May 4th, I was in this really gnarly car crash in Sarasota, Florida. I was on vacation down there with my roommate. And I was just laid up in the hospital it was kind of touch and go, actually.
Oh.
I was really pretty busted up there. So I was in the hospital on and off for a lot of the next 4 or 5 months. And I missed the festival, of course.
Sure.
And, you know, that all those concerns sort of went out the window. And it was more like, okay, let's just get better and get through this thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, of course, eventually I did get better and got back into playing in Chicago. And about five, 6 years went by. And by then I had, you know, a group of peers in Chicago, other songwriters. And I noticed a bunch of them were going to head down to Kerrville. And I remembered Gibson telling me about this place. So I found out about the New Folk Contest, and I sent a tape in, you know, to see if I could be part of that. And true to form for me, I guess I sent it in like a day too late.
Oh.
So it came back unopened, you know, with regrets. And I thought, well, you know, I'd already sort of put the time aside in my mind that that's where I was going to be. So I thought, I'm just going to go, you know, just check it out.
Yeah.
And it was the best possible thing I could have done. One, I didn't have any of the pressure of, you know, a competition to worry about. So I just went down there. I didn't know anybody. I knew, this was 1986, I knew that Guy Clark was supposed to host this thing called the Ballad Tree, which is, again, kind of an open stage in the afternoon under this big tree up on Chapel Hill,
right.
And they'd get the main stage, different main stage performers to host it. So I'd seen Guy the year before in Chicago and was completely blown away by how brilliant he was. And I just thought, well, I'll go and sign up for that day, you know, and shake the guy's hand or something and, you know, lay eyes on him anyway. And so I did that, and I played the song called No Choice, which is sort of about artists and creativity and sort of what drives an artist to do what they do. Mm-hmm. And Guy just took a shine to it. He walked straight over to me after the whole thing was done and said, "Hey, you got a tape of that song? I really like that song."
Whoa.
And, I was flipping out, as you can imagine. And so I said, "All right, don't move. That's my tent right over there." And it was, you know, maybe 50 yards away. I said, "I'm going to go run to my tent and get that tape for you. I got one with me." And so I did, and I gave it to him, and I just thought, you know, that's amazing. And a couple of weeks later, I'm back in Chicago, and I come in from doing the laundry at the laundromat, and I see my message light blinking on the machine, and hit the go button, and it's, hey buddy, this is Guy Clark in Nashville, and I liked your tape, and give me a call sometime. Let's talk about things.
Whoa.
Yeah, I'm doing backflips in my kitchen at
Absolutely.
That point. Yeah, and so I called him up, and he just said, well, you know, what do you want to do? I said, God, all I really want to do is just figure out a way to keep singing and playing for people and somehow make a life out of it, you know, make a living out of it. And he said, okay, well, let's see if we can get you in the music business. And through Guy, I met this fellow, Bob Doyle, who was working at ASCAP at the time. Bob, you know, I went down there, Bob invited me. He said, I got an extra bedroom, just come stay with me. And that was my first trip to Nashville. And God, I think, you know, the next day after I got there, I went to Bob's office, and he said, well, you know, it's 4 o'clock. There's this reception across the street at Country Music Hall of Fame. Let's go over there. And, you know, it's like we walk in the door. He goes, oh, Emmy, come here. I want you to meet this this guy I'm working with, Buddy Monlock. It was Emmy Lou Harris. That was the beginning of my, you know, foray into Nashville. So, yeah, it just...
That's
just
great.
It was a dream, you know.
Absolutely.
And Bob eventually left ASCAP to go into management. any managed myself and this other kid from Oklahoma named Garth Brooks.
There you go. Yeah. But, and that leads to really what I wanted to talk about with some of these, some of the early successes you had with writing songs and having them recorded by by artists. David Wilcox did The Kid. Was that one of the first ones?
That was one of the first ones, yeah. And actually, David and I met up on Chapel Hill again at that first festival in 1986, the one first one I went to. Yeah, yeah, he was just another, you know, new guy at the festival, and a bunch of us were hanging out and trading songs late at night up there.
That's right.
And yeah, I really liked his stuff. And he, you know, he had his little Walkman with him one day. He said, "Will you play a couple... play that kid song, and you were going somewhere in Skeleton. I just want to get copies of those." I'm like, okay. And couple, you know, 2 years go by, and he's got a, now he's landed a deal with A&M, and he's making his first record and wants to record that song.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm the kid who ran away with the surf. Now I am watering elephants, but I sometimes lie awake in the sawdust, dreaming that I'm night in the empty big top. I'm all alone on the high wire. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no net this time. He's the real death defier. I'm the kid. Always looked out.
Let's move ahead to around 2000. This I'm interested in this project that you did with Art Garfunkel and Maya Sharp.
Yeah.
The album Everything Waits to Be Noticed. How did that come about? It was an interesting little blurb that I read about, and I'm just curious as to how that fell together.
Yeah. The producer of the project, a guy named Billy Mann, from Philly originally, but was living in New York then. Just a ball of energy, this guy. And a kind of a pop songwriter and a guy and a producer and artist himself, and but he's just a guy that makes things happen all the time. And he had met my manager Bob Doyle up in New York on one of Bob's trips out there, and Bob encouraged him to come to Nashville and check it out and write with some of his writers. And by that time, I'd left EMI and I was writing for Major Bob Music, which is Bob's company. And so he put Billy and me together, and we wrote like four songs in 4 days, which is
nice.
an unbelievable pace for me, but that's like par for the course for Billy. Anyway, we had a great time. You know, we were connected, and he really liked what I was doing. And I don't know, a year or two goes by, and Billy got approached by some arts people about producing an Art Garfunkel record. They were figuring it's time for Art to make a new record, and somehow Billy had got on their radar, or maybe he'd met Artie, I think. They used to play tennis together, of all things. And so Billy said, you know, the wheels started turning, and he said, okay, I'll do it, but I want to do something different. One, I want to get Artie involved in the songwriting side of things. Because, you know, he just had this feeling about Art that, you know, there's creativity that wasn't getting expressed. And of course, Simon and Garfunkel, all those songs were Paul Simon songs, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if one of the greatest songwriters of all time is your partner, it's easy to feel squelched a little bit,
sure.
You know, when it comes to like, well, what do you think about doing one of mine? Or should I even try one, you know? I mean, I don't know what was going through Artie's mind, but he really hadn't been writing much, if at all. And Billy thought of me, and he also, part of his idea was to not just do an Art solo project, but to get Art together with some songwriters, a couple of songwriters, and to and then record as a trio and make, you know, do these harmony things too, because Art is so great at the harmony
stuff.
Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah. So that was the initial thinking on it, and Billy thought of me. He thought I'd be a good writing partner for Art, and also that our voices would sound good together. And he'd also come across Maya Sharp. Again, you know, they'd written together. I think mm-hmm. it was at like one of these retreats in France or somewhere like that, you know. And he just thought she'd be perfect for this thing. So I hadn't met Maya before, but I had come across one of her records the year before and just totally was in love with it. So, you know, when Billy suggested, you know, she'd be the other person, I was overjoyed, of course.
Yeah.
Billy's the one who put the three of us together. And
so then did you work together as a team, the three of you?
Yeah. You know, Maya was living in L.A. then. She came to Nashville. Artie came to Nashville. I was there already. And we all three met at the Major Bob, you know, publishing company. And we collaborated that first week. You know, I had this song. Billy had a song. And I think me and Art and Billy wrote another song that week. And then we recorded at the end of the week. And we kept getting together that way over the course of next year. And sometimes it'd be Billy and Art and Maya, or me and Maya and Artie, or me and Billy and Artie. And we'd always mm-hmm. try to involve Art in that
yeah.
circle, you know, somewhere. And it was almost always a three-way collaboration that
That's
we would
neat.
Be doing. And it just worked great. I was really pleased with the results. And I was writing things, you know, out of my usual kind of sphere of you know, the go-to chords or feels or rhythms and stuff like that. Because having these other people involved that, you know, have their own mm-hmm. whole set of, you know, tastes and things they like and what sounds good to them.
Spin that wheel, just
I'm Jason Mundock, and this is Around the Wood Stove. My guest today is Buddy Mundlach, a Nashville singer-songwriter whose latest album, The Edge of the World, was released in 2007.
Let's talk about the album, The Edge of the World, your latest record. First of all, there's a mention of it, of this being a song cycle, sort of an introspective journey mm-hmm. from childhood through. How much of this is autobiography?
Well, quite a bit of it, I would say, although maybe in sideways kind of ways.
Yeah.
I mean, all the songs I write have some parts of me in them, even if it's a character I'm creating. And I tend
right.
to do that
You're
a lot.
You're projecting.
I'll write characters like little short stories or something, and it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, ripped from my own diary or something.
Sure.
But thoughts or feelings or projections, like you said.
Was this a collection of songs that you had and had been working on, or was there an intent to say, I want to create this specific album and I'm going to write to that?
Yeah, no, it was pretty much, I had the material, and some of the songs were from way back, you know,
okay.
just songs that, like Baby Cries, I think I wrote that in 1988 sometime when I first got to Nashville.
Okay.
So that's 20 years go by. And,
yeah.
But it was the right, you know, the way I put these songs together came out of just what my life was going through at that time. So
right.
that kind of helped me decide what songs to include on this collection, because it was all things that spoke to me about, you know, this huge upheaval in my life.
Let's talk about a couple of the songs. When I was a little kid, I love this song. I just love the imagery, and it just takes you back to these early days. Talk a little bit about that song. Where'd that come from? What's the story behind it?
Well, that I got invited to back to Park Forest, where I grew up, to sing at they were having this big 50th anniversary celebration in Park Forest, because the town just sort of arose out of the cornfields, you know.
Okay.
They started building, you know, in 1949 or 51 or something like that. And it was, to build, you know, a planned community for the GIs starting families, you know, coming back from World War II. So it had a definite beginning, and they were having this 50th anniversary. And they invited me to come sing at it. I had a few little successes by then, so I was really excited about the whole idea. You know, I was going to get to play in Freedom Hall, where I'd opened for Bob Gibson all those years ago. But I was feeling some nervousness too, because I just knew it wasn't going to be the same Park Forest that I remembered growing up in. I mean, there's always changes. It's just the way of the world, you know. And life continuously alters things, but I wanted it to be the same, you know. So it got me thinking about what it was like for me when I was there and coming back and all this stuff. And that's where that song really came out of.
When I was a little kid, I'd climb up on the roof. I'd lay there on my back, look up at the stars, 'cause they were proof that the world was full of mystery. God and space and time, all of it was mine, at least for a little while. Up there by myself, at the bottom of my bubble, as big as the universe itself, that came to rest right where I lay at the end of every day when I was a little kid. But then the bubble popped, those kind of thoughts got dropped. They rolled right off that roof and never stopped until they hit the ground. 21 years down, never even made a sound.
The Edge of the World is a song that really catches me too. Second track on the album, the title track. Real Beatlesque, late Beatles flavor to me. Talk about that one a little bit.
Yeah, well, you're catching that too, and there's, I mean, definitely the finger picking style, you know, and moving up and down the neck that way. Well, because I learned Blackbird in 19, whenever, you know, in the 70s sometime, that I'm sure that influenced how that song turned out. I got to say, I was also feeling some Ron Sexsmith influence in there, just in the chord changes a little bit. Although I don't know if, you know, anyone listening would pick out the, you know, specifically right. what it meant to me to be,
sure,
you know, doing a Ron Sexsmith thing. But anyway, musically, that's definitely where that was coming from. I was living in Port Aransas at the time, and things were getting rocky, you know, when I wrote that song. And there's, you know, the overriding subject matter of it is like, what are we going to do? You know, the two of us, are we going to stay together and try and work this out? Or are we going to go our separate ways? And there's all this, you know, ocean and water and boats and stuff in there, because I'm living, you know, at the ocean.
Yeah.
On the Gulf of Mexico. So that was just working with what was around me and what was going on in my life.
All the words that fell landed hard, time will tell how many leave a scar. I'm floating over my life with you. Baby, what am I gonna do? You're sorry in your way so something you won't say, you won't even try. You're swimming further away from shore. I can hardly see you anymore. Don't swim over the edge of the world. It's an awful long way down with nobody around to help you land. Don't swim over the edge of the world. We've still got our little boat. It's leaky but it floats. Take my hand. We've come a long, long way.
The song How It Goes.
Yeah.
Talk about that one a little bit.
I wrote that in the early 90s, and I... it was just kind of a reaction of the during the week, you know, after somebody had ended a relationship that I'd been in with her for a couple of years, and the first song I wrote that week was kind of an angry, you know, bitter, had a bitter edge to it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the second one where I'd had a little more time to think about it and come around to be a little more philosophical about it, and so in a way it's me talking to myself. I mean, the song is in the third person, or maybe it's second person. I forget how you define that, but it's you. You know, I keep saying there's a way that you're reaching, a way that you touch. You know, when you're not quite sure, it'll count for too much. But the you is really me in the song. It's me talking to myself and trying to talk myself through this event and this turn of life.
Yeah.
You know,
there's a way that you're reaching. There's a way that you touch. When you're not quite sure, it'll count for too much. When the one you lay down with, who you thought you knew, might just roll away and it's a mystery. Puzzle it over. Was it something you did, or something forgotten? Well, which was it, kid? In the morning she'll tell you the how and the why, but you won't understand it no matter how you try.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to chat about all this and your backstory. This is great. And we're really excited to have you tonight at the Wood Stove House for a house concert.
Thanks.
You bet. Buddy Mundlach is a songwriter and performer based in Nashville, Tennessee. To learn more about Buddy, check his tour schedule and buy his music, visit him online at buddymundlach.com or link up from our website, woodstovehouse.com, where you can listen to past episodes, find show notes, send feedback, or find out more about our Wood Stove House concert series. Around the Wood Stove is a production of the Wood Stove House. Find us on the web at woodstovehouse.com.
We might be related somewhere way back there, you know.